This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Kevin Gallagher is producing. Thank you for your support this week, and thank you for contributing during this hour of programming on WRKF. We immensely appreciate it, and we look forward to being with you for many more years on this show, and glad you're making all the shows that you hear throughout the week and throughout the year possible on WRKF. Governor Bobby Jindal is being urged by Democrats and others, including advocacy groups, to reconsider his opposition to expanding the state's Medicaid coverage now that the presidential campaign is over and the president's reelection last month certainly has some implications regarding health care throughout the country and in Louisiana. And with us to talk about the Medicaid situation in studio are Alma Stewart. She is the president of the Louisiana Center for Health Equity, and also is in studio is James Gilmore, who is a member of the board of directors for the organization, the Louisiana Center for Health Equity. Let's begin with you, Alma. What is your impression about where we stand as a state on the provisions of the Obamacare that the governor is reluctant or actually adamant about not participating in?
Well, I think Louisiana has a tremendous opportunity ahead of it to take advantage of the Obamacare, as many refer to it. The Medicaid expansion is particularly the area that we are interested in because of the huge number of people in Louisiana who are uninsured who could benefit from this by the state taking advantage of implementing that option. We have over 700,000 people in Louisiana who are uninsured, or uninsured rate of 20%, which is one of the highest in the country. And we are interested in our state taking advantage of this tremendous opportunity to cover those individuals under the Medicaid program and also to shore up our economic scenario for health care.
297-5633, if you'd like to join us. The email address is inkstershow@wrkf.org. The governor says, here in Louisiana, we will continue to do what we have always done, and that means standing up for our people and doing what we think is right, no matter who is president. And the governor has said that he will not change his position on Medicaid expansion. His health secretary, Bruce Greenstein, is with the governor, as you would expect, on this issue. James Gilmore, what happens if the governor stands adamantly against this, despite the fact that the president has won re-election?
Well, Jim, sadly what happens is that over 400,000 citizens in our state could possibly live lives uninsured. People will go without health insurance, people will get sick, people will not be able to become well, and people will not be able to go to work and make a living for themselves. And unfortunately, if the governor continues to take this stance, that's what will happen. It is our hope, though, that citizens across the state of Louisiana, elected officials, and others will work to demonstrate to the governor and show the governor that the opportunity to expand Medicaid is standing up for Louisiana citizens. He will be doing that if he allowed for the Affordable Care Act to be implemented in the state, particularly and specifically the Medicaid expansion.
Well, the governor is not alone among his Republican brothers and sisters. There are other governors who are planning on doing what he's doing, and that means defiantly going against the Medicaid expansion that's in the new federal health care law. And so it may be a matter of having to adjust based on his actions. What happens if he doesn't appeal, or if he doesn't respond to your appeal? What happens at that point, James and Alma?
Well, what happens, as I stated before, is that, you know, folks go without health insurance. However, there are opportunities for us to participate or to work on the federal level and coordinate with the federal government to provide some form of health options for our citizens, even though the governor has also rejected the insurance exchange program. And so, you know, the most negative option and the unfortunate option is people go uninsured. But I absolutely don't believe that our governor doesn't care about his citizens. I simply believe that the governor is stuck on the fiscal matter. You know, he's indicated that it's going to cost the state $3.7 billion to fund this program, and Kaiser and other studies have showed that it would cost about $1.2 billion to fund the program through 2022. But let's also be aware that the federal government is here stepping in to help finance this program and to help support this program. And so, you know, the fiscal argument just doesn't make sense.
Alma?
And also, one of the concerns that our organization has is the fact that the citizens of Louisiana aren't being adequately represented in terms of their voice. And what we hope to do through this campaign is to mobilize and to encourage regular people to get involved in the political process, to let their elected officials, including the governor, know how this benefits them. We are talking about real people with real lives who are going without health care in this state, and we're seeing the trend turn downward in that regard mm-hmm. with what's going on with our charity hospital systems and the cuts to our health care, public health care system. So there are many, many reasons why it just makes good sense politically and from a policy perspective, as well as from a human perspective, for our policymakers in the legislative branch and the governor's, the administrative branch, to take another look at this whole issue.
Well, the governor has said that he has no intention of expanding the Medicaid program in Louisiana and will work with other Republicans to do everything he can to repeal Obamacare. Now, it appears that would be unlikely with the election results giving Democrats a majority in the U.S. Senate and also a decisive victory in the race for president, and actually gained some seats in the U.S. House of Representatives. But with us also is Stephen Spires with the Louisiana Budget Project. And the governor says, as James pointed out, that this is long-term going to cost the state more money than Louisiana stands to gain. Do you buy that rationale?
Well, Jim, it's certainly true that there are some costs associated with Medicaid expansion, but there are also a lot of savings associated. You know, right now, the idea that we somehow don't pay in other ways for the large number of uninsured people in Louisiana is untrue. You know, the state has a lot of programs it funds to provide care to the uninsured. We pay higher health care premiums, those who have private insurance, businesses and families, because of how many people are uninsured. So if you can bring in Medicaid expansion, what's critical is it brings in so many more federal dollars. It brings in, for the first 3 years, it's 100% federally funded. The state slowly chips in after that, but never has to pay more than 10% of the entire cost. Right now, we pay 35% of the cost of the Medicaid program, and for some of these state and local health care programs, we pay 100% of the cost. So there are some new costs, there are some new savings, but I think overall, the benefits, what we get for that modest state investment, are huge.
Well, what's the do-or-die date on whether or not the state can participate?
There is no do-or-die date. The federal government's been pretty clear that a state can opt in and opt out at any time. I think it's important for us to get in on day one because, like I said, the first 3 years from 2014 through 2016 are 100% federally funded. So if the state waits to 2016 or 2017, we're actually going to get less federal money than is on the table right now.
Well, the governor says what we're saying is a government-run program, a new entitlement program. We can't afford the ones we have. It makes absolutely no sense at a time when we have over $15 trillion of debt. That's the governor's line on this. Alma, you're shaking your head.
I'm not a fiscal expert. My interest is, although I have worked in state government and I'm familiar with the state budget process and I am well aware of the budget problems that we have in our state. However, going back to this specific issue, it is a policy issue that has significant fiscal incentives. So I can't speak to the broader budget and fiscal mm-hmm. issues, but on this particular issue, there are huge financial incentives for Louisiana to play.
Okay, we're going to take a short break. We will return with Alma Stewart and James Gilmore and Stephen Spires, and we will talk about Medicaid expansion and whether there is a looming crisis in Louisiana as a result of Governor Jindal's steadfast defiance against Obamacare. Back after this brief pause on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. In a few moments, we'll hear from Bill Grimes, the esteemed music professor from Louisiana State University, commenting about the death of Dave Brubeck, among other matters. But we continue. Other Republican governors, a few others, are starting to back away from opposition to implementing parts of President Obama's health care law, but Bobby Jindal says he's not reconsidering. We're not implementing the exchange. That's from Governor Jindal. Clear, simple, concise. He says even though U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services Kathleen Sebelius has extended by 1 month the November 16th deadline for states to notify the federal government of their intentions regarding exchanges, the governor says Louisiana will be sending in a rejection letter, which they, as a state, we have done. And the Affordable Care Act mandated the creation of exchanges in each state. And, of course, it also has big implications for Medicaid, of which, 400,000 people in Louisiana are on Medicaid. And with us to talk about this a bit more are three people who are in the know about Medicaid, James Gilmore and Alma Stewart. Alma is the president, and James is a board member of the Louisiana Center for Health Equity, and Stephen Spires from the Louisiana Budget Project. Nancy in St. Gabriel, please be brief. Nancy, you're on the air with our guests.
Good morning. I just wanted to point out and emphasize that Louisiana, from research I've read about, has one of the lowest cutoffs for income cutoffs for Medicaid eligibility already. And research also shows that states that don't cover more people under Medicaid have higher death rates. That's what this is about. It's about allowing more people to die, which apparently we're already doing in Louisiana because we have a lower cutoff rate for Medicaid eligibility than many other states do. So I just wanted to redefine the focus of from money to saving lives.
All right. Stephen, would you respond?
Yeah, Nancy is correct on that. We do have one of the lowest Medicaid eligibility cutoffs for adults right now. If you're a parent, you cannot make more than 15% of the federal poverty line, which is, for a family of three, $3,000 in annual income. And if you're a childless adult, you can't qualify at all, regardless of your income. So this is one of the reasons that we have such a high number of people who are uninsured. And she's also right that recent research, both out of the Southwest and the Northeast, has shown that states that voluntarily expanded Medicaid over the past few decades do have lower mortality rates. So it is a very serious issue, a literally life and death issue.
Well, Fred Cerise, who has been the former head of LSU Hospitals, says under the Medicaid expansion provisions, the federal government would pick up 100% of the cost for 3 years and then slowly drop participation the next 3 years down to 90%. And Louisiana, according to Fred, could provide health insurance for several hundred thousand people, about 400,000, by shifting them from a program that requires the state's taxpayers to pony up 40% of the costs into a program that at its most, according to Fred Cerise, after 2020 would cost the state 10%. Bruce and Walden, you're on. Good morning, Bruce.
Yeah, hello, all and some of my favorite people. I just wanted to relate this conversation a bit to the recent 60 Minutes segment on Alan Levine, the previous DHH secretary, whose organization is now embroiled in a DOJ investigation of massive Medicaid fraud, in which the theme of the program was over and over again that this organization, Health Management Associates, which is now advising Jindal on so-called health care reform in Louisiana, was all about profits and not people, was never about care, was always about exploiting the situation to maximize profit. And to just keep in mind that Greenstein is the hand-picked successor by Levine for DHH.
All right, but I think it would be a bit unfair to say everything that Alan Levine stands for, that Bruce Greenstein stands for, and mind you, these are only allegations and investigations. So far, to my knowledge, there have been none or convictions. But back to the larger theme of the governor refusing to participate in Obamacare, and in particular Medicaid expansion, we've had three guests comment that they don't think it's a good idea for the state. And it sounds like you're not going to be able to convince the governor to change his mind. So with that as the backdrop for this issue, Alma, what do you do?
Well, one of the reasons the Louisiana Center for Health Equity exist is to give a voice to people across the state of Louisiana as it relates to health issues, and specifically regarding those individuals who typically don't have a voice. We represent those who are most impacted by health disparities or disparities in health and health care across Louisiana. So one of the things we're doing is mobilizing a campaign called Healthcare for Everyone Louisiana to educate people at all levels, hopefully to help educate the governor, provide additional information about what his constituents would like to see and what the needs of regular everyday people across this state are, and to hopefully engage people across the state in this process of having their voices heard by communicating with their legislators and so forth.
All right, James, final comments from you.
Absolutely. I want to encourage folks to call their legislators, visit our website, Louisiana Center for Health Equity, email us at info@lahealthequity.org, and join our campaign to provide our residents the right to live, to have healthy lives, and oppose the governor.
Well, all right. Well, you're calling for an appeal here, and I don't know that that would be fair, and I would encourage anybody who's in favor of what the governor is doing to call their legislators as well. That's what the democratic process is all about. If you like it, let people know, and if you don't like it, let people know. Stephen?
So it's the path we're on right now is unsustainable. We have 1 in 4 adults uninsured. These cuts to the LSU health system are really going to put health access at risk for the uninsured, going to put financial stress on providers. And in our view, Medicaid expansion is the answer to both these problems. It expands coverage to the working poor and low-income uninsured adults in our state. It brings in new federal dollars that can help pay for that care.
Right. Well, we thank you, and best of luck to you. And
thank you.
And we will certainly follow this every step of the way. Now, tomorrow is Election Day here in the greater Baton Rouge area and across the state, and certainly we encourage people to get out and vote, and in some areas there are some major ballot measures, and other areas there may not be the sexiness of a congressional runoff as there is in the Lafayette area with Jeff Landry and the incumbent from Lafayette, Charles Bustani, both of them incumbents, and that district now spans a good portion of southern Louisiana, all the way down to Thibodaux. But we encourage you to vote wherever you are, and unfortunately, it looks like only about 1 in 4 people in our state will vote tomorrow. But the polls open at 6 o'clock, and they're open until 8 p.m. tomorrow, and we exhort our listening audience to participate. And speaking of a man who is accustomed to participating with some of the greats of the music world, William Grimes is with us, LSU music professor. You've been at LSU now how long?
This is my 29th year.
Yeah, we had Kevin Cope here yesterday, 29 years for him.
I guess we came the same time.
Yeah, and your people who came from other parts of the world and decided to stay.
I'll never forget the first new faculty orientation I attended. And this was in a time when LSU was really trying to make Research One status under Jim Wharton, and we all stood up and introduced ourselves, and we were all from different parts of the country. Nobody was from Louisiana. They were bringing in people from outside as fast as they could, people from all over the world. But the administrators we were hearing from were career administrators at LSU, and they had those deep Louisiana accents, which were so charming. I'm not sure what it's like now, but it was like that's the way it was back then, 29 years ago.
You had no idea you'd end up spending most of your life in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, though.
My wife and I have often commented, we planned to stay here 3 or 4 years and move on, and we got here and realized, wow, this is really a good situation.
Well, Dr. Bill Grimes is a man who has served LSU and the state of Louisiana proud. He has been one of the nation's leading pops orchestra arrangers. Over 100 scores to your credit?
Yeah, more than that. That's an old bio.
So are we up to 200 now?
No, not that many, but it's...
Over 100.
I quit counting.
That's a lot. And you have been on this program a few times in the past. And on one occasion, I know we were talking about Dave Brubeck. I think it was a 50th anniversary
of
Time Out.
It was... Well, it was 2009 because that was the 50th anniversary of that famous album, Time Out.
Which included this memorable selection. Why was timeout such a phenomenon then and now?
Hard to say. In 1959, if you put everything in an historical perspective, this was a significant departure from the music that had been put forth as modern and mainstream jazz. Very few people had investigated music that had odd, unusual time signatures. Also on this record was Blue Rondo a la Turk, which the band discovered when they were on tour in Turkey, just I think earlier that year. And they had heard some Turkish folk music. It was called a karsalama. That was the Turkish name of this dance music. And it had an unusual metrical pattern. 1-2-1-2-1-2-1-2-3, 1-2-1-2-1-2-1-2-3, 1-2-1-2-1-2-3, 1-2-3-1-2-3, 1-2-3-1-2-3. It was a repeating pattern,
mm-hmm.
And it intrigued the band. This was the band with Paul Desmond, Eugene Wright, and Joe Morello, I think, was the drummer. So they got back to the States and decided to do an entire album using unusual time signatures, meter signatures. And that was brand new for the time, for 1959, and later would spawn people such as Don Ellis and others who actually said, the only thing I play in 4-4 is take 5.
Well, Dave Brubeck, the pianist and composer who made jazz popular in the 1950s and 60s with recordings like Take 5, which we just heard, and Time Out, the first jazz album, by the way, to sell 1 million copies.
I think that's correct.
Yeah. He died this week at 91, one day short of birthday number 92, in Norwalk, Connecticut, on his way to see his cardiologist.
Uh-huh.
So it ended 1-2-3 for Dave Brubeck on Wednesday, and he leaves quite a legacy. And he's a guy, we talked a bit about him yesterday, Bill, who performed right up to the end, didn't he?
Yes, he did. Well, you know, he comes from, he has a very musical family. He has 4 sons, I believe, and all of them are heavily involved in jazz and music. In fact, I believe one of them, maybe Darius Brubeck, went to South Africa and started an jazz education program in South Africa. When I think of Dave Brubeck, and I teach this music in my jazz history course at LSU, when I talk about Brubeck, I think it's important that we remember that not only was he a fine jazz pianist, he was really known for his compositions. When I listen to him play, I'm more intrigued and captivated by the way he exploits our expectations as a composer. The listener always have expectations. And Brubeck, being a wonderful composer, knew how to take the listener to a certain point, set up a series of expectations, and then turn left and give us something brand new. That's the mark of a great composer. So for me, Dave Brubeck is actually more interesting as a composer than as a player.
Well, he was old enough to have served in World War II, and today, of course, is the 71st anniversary of the bombing of Pearl Harbor, and Dave Brubeck was in an army band in 1943, and he was fortunately kept away from the front lines in the Battle of the Bulge because one of his superiors saw his musical talent and wanted to protect him. And as we go to the break, we're hearing Blue Rondo a la Turk, and we will talk with Bill Grimes about this remarkable piece of music, also from Time Out, and how it has affected legions of students and music aficionados for more than 50 years. We pause for this brief timeout.
Oh, wow. On what a segue.
This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. 877-217-5757. Bill Grimes with us in our final segment. LSU music professor for 29 years. He earned his bachelor's degree from the Cincinnati College of the Conservatory of Music and graduate degrees from the Eastman School of Music in Rochester, New York. Kevin, can you cut that down? We're getting some spillover from a couple of different artists. In fact, it sounded like Jim Morrison, of all people, in the midst of a remembrance of Dave Brubeck. By the way, Jim Morrison would have been 69 years old tomorrow and passed away at the age of 27. Dave Brubeck made it to 91, one day short of 92, and he died this week in Norwalk, Connecticut. Dave Brubeck influenced many, including our guest Bill Grimes. And as far as Take Five, would that be the most recognizable piece of music worldwide for jazz enthusiasts?
Worldwide, not for jazz enthusiasts. For the general public, when you play this piece of music for them, they associate it with the word jazz, which is fascinating to me because I can't remember the last time I played this tune. It's clever. It's interesting. We just never play it because when we want to play something by Dave Brubeck, there are much better pieces out there. There's a tune called In Your Own Sweet Way that is just marvelous. There's a tune, very clever tune called Raggy Waltz, which is a waltz, but it doesn't sound like a waltz. And then there's the famous piece he wrote for Ellington called The Duke that Miles Davis recorded with Gil Evans. So Brubeck's contributions are much... Take Five is what the public knows. Blue Rondo a la Turk is what the public knows because of this album. But as far as what I play with my colleagues at LSU and other people around the country, we rarely play this.
Really? When were you first exposed to it?
I was in high school playing at the Officers Club at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, next to my hometown. And some people asked for it, and we played it. It's a great teaching and learning piece
well,
for young
Blue
students.
Well, Blue Rondo in particular, right?
Oh, well, Blue Rondo a la Turk is I think it's indicative of what Brubeck brought to the jazz idiom in the 1950s. And it was not without controversy. Of course, we can't talk about controversy on your show,
sure,
can we?
Sure we can. Why was it controversial?
Well, not the piece, but Brubeck himself received great accolades from the press and had his picture on the front of Time magazine in November of 1954. And members of the African American jazz community were sort of, you know, they're scratching their heads trying to figure out, wait a minute, this doesn't sound like jazz to us. And that's because Brubeck's background, he studied with Darius Milhaud, the famous French composer. He had a strong European influence in his music. Mm-hmm. He was heavily influenced by European classical tradition. And it seemed to be a diversion or a stepping away from the roots and origins that the African-American musicians had been developing. Even though Brubeck played the blues, his music did not sound as if it were coming from the New Orleans, that tradition. It was departing from the tradition. So there was that little bit of controversy. Now, as far as Blue Rondo a la Turk goes, it is, it's a great teaching and learning piece for my students because it's clever, it's intellectual, and if you stick with it long enough, they finally do get to play in the blues. But it doesn't sound like the blues.
Well, here it is. Thank you. was cutting edge in 1959, and I guess in some ways it still is.
Well, it still is for my students because, you know, I don't even know when my students were born. They're just
after 1959.
Yeah, way after. So when I play this for the students, I teach them about the fact that it's got these two meters in it. It's got the small meter, 1-2-1-2-1-2-1-2-3, but at the same time it has a larger meter that's superimposed, which is just simply 1-2-3-1-2-3. It sets up a cross rhythm that is fascinating, intriguing, but it doesn't sound like it's coming from New York City. It doesn't sound like it's coming from Chicago. It sounds like it's coming from Europe. And that's where some of the controversy erupted. In fact, some books, some scholars have said that the entire West Coast cool jazz movement helped to spawn the reaction of the hard bop musicians such as Art Blakey and Miles Davis and Horace Silver and people who wanted to move away from this European intellectual cleverness.
A listener wants to know about the contributions of Paul Desmond, the sax player. He was with Dave Brubeck for a very long time.
He was. Desmond is one of my favorite people to study. Right now, that's where in there. If they're hearing what we're hearing, that's the blues section. Mm-hmm. They are playing the blues. Yeah, that's the blues.
Mm-hmm.
Desmond is an interesting character, very quiet man. And somebody, I think it was Gene Lees, asked him, "What kind of sound do you want to make, Paul?" Because Paul Desmond had a truly unique sound. It was light. It had some air in it, almost vibratoless. And he said, "I want to make a sound like a dry martini," which is one of my favorite quotes. Desmond and Brubeck met while they were in the Army together and started playing together. And Desmond, I think, was a little bit like Strayhorn was to Ellington, sort of an alter ego. But they motivated each other musically. Desmond is also the one with the famous, he was a punster, Jim, I got to tell you. Do you like puns?
I do.
Okay. I think your audience will get this because they probably know T.S. Eliot's quote. Desmond had been dating a young woman who broke off the relationship because she wanted to start dating a guy who owned a bank.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody asked Desmond what happened to the relationship, and he said, "Yes, that's how it ended. She went out not on a whim, but with a banker."
He died at 52 years old with lung cancer, Paul Desmond.
Yes.
And Brubeck smoked in his day, didn't he?
I guess.
Almost all of them did, and they're playing in smoky nightclubs. How does a guy like that last to 92 years old?
Well, I think jazz musicians probably have sort of the same life expectancy, frailties, problems that the rest of the population has. I mean, Charlie Parker died at the age of 35, but his cohort, Dizzy Gillespie, lived into his 70s. That's one of the things I talk about with my students. It's hard to make these generalizations that, you know, jazz musicians are drug users and bad people.
Well, Bill Grimes is not a bad person.
Well, nobody's figured it out yet.
And certainly Dave Brubeck was not. And as we leave, his style changed over the years. He was a vigorous, aggressive type mm-hmm. of pianist. And by the end, in his 90s, he had smoothed out a bit.
Well, he also wrote some profound religious music, some sacred concert music, which is really wonderful stuff. So this is, you know, Take Five, the album, Time Out, all that music is what he's known for, but in the jazz community, we know him for these other pieces that are, I wish people would investigate, because they're marvelous.
When the occasion is appropriate, we'll bring Bill Grimes back and talk more about other pieces. But thank you, Bill. Thank you, everybody,
thank
for
you.
Listening, and stay tuned.